On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, a conversation about President Trump's executive order directed at historically black colleges and universities. Last month, he signed the order after meeting with more than 100 presidents of HBCUs. What does the order say and not say about the future of HBCUs? Jarrett Carter of HBCU Digest joins me. Plus, I'll speak with two leaders who attended the meeting with President Trump, Johnny Taylor, the president and CEO of the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, and Dr. David Wilson, the president of Morgan State University. Then, Big Brothers Big Sisters of the Greater Chesapeake is one of several organizations in Maryland matching young people with adult mentors. Mentoring works, but are enough people stepping up to make enough of a difference? Kara Ritter, the president of Big Brothers Big Sisters of the Greater Chesapeake, will let us know. Midday starts right after the news. And good afternoon, folks. Glad you're with us this afternoon. I'm Tom Hall, and you're listening to Midday. Today, we're going to spend some time talking about historically black colleges and universities. Maryland is home to four of the nation's more than 100 HBCUs. Last month, President Trump issued an executive order directed at HBCUs after meeting with nearly 100 presidents and leaders of those institutions. After the meeting, some who attended were somewhat critical of the president. They called the meeting merely a photo op, and several HBCU presidents say that they were given little time to discuss their concerns and talk about strategies to help their institutions succeed. The executive order takes the White House initiative on historically black colleges and universities away from the purview of the Department of Education, and it puts it at the White House, placing it under the director appointed by the Trump administration, and that person has yet to be appointed by the president. The order also calls for several reports, and it establishes committees to identify federal and private funding sources. President Trump is not the first president to issue an order directed at HBCUs. Beginning with the Carter administration, every president has signed a document pledging support to the schools. But those documents have not always translated into impactful funding or resources for the institutions. More than 70% of students attending HBCUs receive Pell Grants, compared to 33% of students overall. While President Trump's latest budget proposal does keep the federal Pell Grant program, it cuts it by nearly $4 billion. Jarrett Carter is the founding editor of HBCUDigest.com, an online daily news blog dedicated to coverage of historically black colleges and universities throughout the United States, and he joins me here in Studio Wave. Welcome. Good
to
meet you.
Appreciate it.
So what does this order say from the president, and for you, what are the big takeaways?
Much of the language is maintained through orders we've seen in the past, but I think the big deal is that the organizational leadership of the White House initiative on HBCUs is actually reporting to the White House. And that's been something a lot of the presidents and the advocates have been asking for many years and have just now come to fruition. Now, what does that mean? The perception is that if you have someone who's advocating for HBCUs actually steps away from the president of the United States, that there's more latitude for that office to be able to make a call to agencies and say, hey, what are we doing for HBCUs? When reports are generated, there's more of a pressure to say, let's get these reports out and done. Let's get the information out to see how are we maintaining our commitments to these institutions. And so I think that while a lot of people, you know, don't necessarily know the nuances of why that's important, I could see, you know, why the reaction is, oh, you know, we kind of just
about access right. and proximity.
Access and proximity. And what does that translate to in the way of resources? So it's a pretty big deal.
Given that Betsy DeVos mm-hmm. has been appointed by the president as the Secretary of Education, were people any more or less interested in having this initiative placed in the White House rather than the Department of Education? In other words, because this particular individual, who was very controversial, she barely squeaked by in her confirmation hearing. I mean, the vice president had to cast the deciding vote. You say that this has been a longstanding aspiration of people in the HBCU community, but do you think Betsy DeVos up the ante at all?
Again, this is something they've been asking for years, so I don't think Secretary DeVos was the catalyst for it. You may have some individuals who say, yeah, we need to get away from there. But I don't. That was not the impetus for the move.
So what prompted the meeting with HBCU presidents and leaders?
This is something that had been in the works even since the campaign trail. If you recall, Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders had been active on their campaign trails reaching out to HBCU. So this has long been a political catalyst for how do you support African-Americans and African-American communities. Of course, you do it through the institutions that have long served our interest. So all the folks who were interested in becoming president knew if you want to captivate black voters, let's go to where they are. President Trump, or now President Trump, wasn't a stranger to that. While he didn't do it on the campaign trail, he was active in conversations with folks from Thurgood Marshall College Fund, from UNCF, from NAFIO. And so part of that discussion was taking place about, you know, if we're going to do something substantive for HBCUs, these are some of the things that we're looking for. And I think in the days leading up to that meeting, where more than 80 presidents came to Washington to not only meet with President Trump and his cabinet, but also members of the various committees, the Secretary of Education, as well as other ranking members of Congress, that a lot of their ideas were put forward. You know, we'd like to see a certain percentage of aspirational funding going to HBCUs. We want to see a certain amount of commitment. We want to see the initiative move to the White House. So there was a list of things that had been produced that had been in the works for months. And that culminating moment was that meeting.
Did Omarosa Manigault have much to do with this? She's one of the high-profile African-American people in the Trump administration. She's actually, frankly, one of the very few African-American people in the Trump administration. She's a graduate of an HBCU, a couple of them, I guess.
Yeah, correct.
Do you think that she certain people have characterized her as being an impetus behind this?
Depending on who you talk to, she is the one. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you've listened to her dialogue in media and even during the meetings, people were surprised about how well-versed she was in the funding levels, the impact of changes to the Pell Grant plus loan programming. So this isn't someone who came in as a novice and just saying, well, I went to two HBCUs, so I'm here to help. She's someone who's studied up on it, who's been in communication with executives and with advocates. And, you know, as we move forward, I think she's going to continue to be a positive voice in the administration on behalf of black colleges.
So can you tell us what this initiative actually is? I mean, this initiative existed, you know, as we said, started back in the Carter administration, mm-hmm. 40 years ago. What is it actually? What does it mean?
So it functions in the way that it's a liaison between the White House or between the federal government and the historically black colleges. And the primary objectives are to do a couple of things. One, how do we figure out how government and its various agencies can support the higher education enterprise, specifically in a historically black context? How do we get more graduates out of these schools? How do we conduct more research in these schools? How do we transform communities with economic development through these schools? So that's part one. The other one is to facilitate private partnerships between companies and HBCUs to help develop a self-starting engine where they can get more resources and not be so reliant on federal resources. You've seen that play out a little bit with recent partnerships between TMCF and UNCF with the co-founder.
TMCF is the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, right. And we're going to be speaking to the president and CEO of that organization after a break.
Correct. And then United UNCF Negro College Fund.
Right.
And you've seen the Koch Foundation give upwards of $50 million to two of these organizations for scholarships to support the development of certain research hubs and other functions that make HBCU stronger. What the other goal of this initiative is to say, now we're talking about resources, but how do we do some things like support capacity at HBCUs? How do we make sure that we have proper infrastructure with technology and facilities? What ways can the federal government support that? What ways can the federal government support in training faculty to have partnerships with other institutions? So that research that's being done that is important to a variety of industries in the country is being done in some areas that have been historically underserved.
How does President Trump's executive order, we mentioned that every president since President Carter has issued some sort of executive order or some similar thing. Mm-hmm. How does Mr. Trump's executive order differ, for example, from President Obama's?
It moves the White House initiative.
So that's
it.
That's basically the big thing.
Even if you look at the language of the order itself, much of it mirrors what was done under the Obama administration. And that has been to the point of consternation for a couple of presidents and a lot of alumni. But again, I think it's critical to note that with a president who ascended to the White House as a businessman, and in all of his language on HBCUs has talked about, let's do business with HBCUs, this is a very positive step in the way that he has the ability to call people with whom he's done business and to say, look, these are thriving engines of economic opportunity in Black communities, right? So if we want to make sure that we're developing these areas and developing these cities and towns, get on the phone with these schools and let's see what we can make happen. What does that mean? We're going to have a lot of opportunities with STEM. We're going to have a lot of opportunities with manufacturing. We're going to have a lot of opportunities in other commercial areas like retail, which is a sore spot for many HBCUs, particularly in the rural South. So I'm optimistic about it. Time will tell how long those kind of partnerships will take to play out. Time will tell how cooperative presidents and boards will be with the administration, given all the controversy surrounding it. But I think if both sides avail themselves, the possibilities can be endless.
I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. My guest today, Jarrett Carter. He's the founding editor of HBCUDigest.com. We're talking about historically Black colleges and universities. And after a break, we're going to talk to Dr. David Wilson from Morgan State University and the president and CEO of the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, Johnny Taylor. So Jarrett Carter, it's no news to you and anybody else that Mr. Trump is a very divisive
right.
individual.
Right.
There were a lot of people who were angry and disappointed that the presidents of so many of these HBCU institutions actually showed up at the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Just meeting with Mr. Trump was enough to get their to raise their ire. At Howard University, there was spray paint on the campus that said, "Welcome to the Trump Plantation. The overseer is Wayne A.I. Frederick." He's the president of Howard University,
mm-hmm.
Which is considered by many to be the sort of the Harvard of HBCUs. I'm sure there's a whole lot of alums of other places that would beg to differ.
Or Harvard is the Howard.
Or Harvard is the Howard. Yeah, that's a better way of putting it.
Right.
But, I mean, how in general, the subscribers to you, you have more than 100,000 subscribers to your blog. I mean, how are folks reacting to the fact that they even, you know, grace the doors of the place?
Much in the same. And I think that is a testament to, you know, a lot of the rhetoric we heard, you know, during the campaign season. And it's completely understandable. And the students at Howard, I think if you would talk to President Frederick, he would say, you know, that's what students ought to do. When they are politically dissatisfied, they ought to make statements. That's not in the Howard tradition of spray painting on the grounds, but, you know, it's in their tradition to say we're not satisfied with what's happening. But I think it's important to note that if the President of the United States extends an invitation, you got to take it. If it wasn't Trump, you know, there's another side of the equation that would be unhappy with what the outcome may have been. And it still would have been, you know, an opportunity to meet with, you know, the leader of the free world. You don't pass that up. But more importantly, there are a couple questions I think we have to ask. One, if you're dissatisfied with HBCUs going to meet with President Trump, there's something to be said that no other sector of higher education was even pressured to have that meeting. Not community colleges, not technical colleges, not predominantly white institutions. Only HBCUs were in the position to say, we have to go do this because we're in this dire of a situation. I think we ought to dissect that discussion before any other else in terms of cultural, political things. But then the other part of it is you have to understand that for HBCUs, navigation and conversation with folks who ideologically oppose what we may believe in is nothing new. If you're in the South, you talk to a few racists. You talk to a few racist governors. You talk to a few racist lawmakers.
Right.
So we ought not pretend that a conversation with
surprise.
President Trump is the worst thing to have happened, because we've done this on local levels for generations.
Yeah.
So I think if you have those two perspectives, you kind of have a different take on, you know, what these presidents set out to do. And I commend them, you know, for putting their personal brands and their careers on the line to do what is best for our students.
And, of course, when it comes to the controversies about meeting with the president, there were people in the Black Lives Matter movement who refused to meet with President Obama.
Right.
You know, I mean, this is a decision that a lot of people are making to make a particular political statement.
Mm-hmm.
President Obama is an interesting dimension of this.
Mm-hmm.
Was the HBCU community generally happy with the way HBCUs were treated and supported during the 8 years of the Obama administration?
I think some of the presidents were. I know Dr. Wilson, who will be coming on later, was one who was an advocate of his administration. Dr. John Wilson at Morehouse was another, former executive director of that White House initiative we've been discussing. So some folks were optimistic about a lot of the symbolism that President Obama represented, not just for, you know, Black communities and Black people, but also the offshoots that it could have created for HBCUs. Unfortunately, you know, from my view and the view of many others, it didn't translate into resources, and it didn't translate into policy that would have lasted to support HBCUs in the way that it did for other things that President Obama prioritized. So it was a really interesting 8 years from cultural and racial perspectives. But in the end, I think if we're just looking at where did the money go and did it help, the answer is no. And that's factually based. And you don't have to, you know, reside in any kind of conjecture about that. It is what it is.
And it's interesting. We should note that the President Trump's executive order says nothing about directing actual money.
And as did President Obama's.
Right.
And it's rare to see a number in an executive order.
Right.
And I think that the budget is what everyone was waiting for. And the other interesting part to take about President Trump's budget in conjunction with this order is higher education or education period got cut by 19%. But all the program and most of the program that are vital to HBCU staying open and operable stayed put. So if we're in a period of austerity, but this sector and this fund that supports that sector stays put, that's something to be said. Now, the other thing that we have to look at is so much outside of the Department of Education came to HBCUs from the Department of Homeland Security, Department of Defense. That's where the money is going to come from. So we have to look a little bit closely at those areas to see if funds and initiatives that have been there for HBCUs remain.
Jared Carter, he's the founding editor of HBCUDigest.com. It's a blog that covers historically black colleges and universities. This has really been informative and helpful. Thank you so much. I appreciate
it. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
When we come back, more on HBCUs with the president of Morgan State University, Dr. David Wilson, and Johnny C. Taylor. He's the president and CEO of the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. If you are a student, a faculty member, or an alum of an HBCU, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think the future holds for HBCUs in the age of Trump? And what are the issues that you think are the most important ones facing historically black colleges and universities? To call us here at Midday, our number 410-662-8780. To send us an email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. More when we come back. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday here on your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about historically black colleges and universities. Now we're going to turn to two HBCU leaders who attended a meeting with President Trump last month when he signed an executive order that we've been talking about so far. That's the thing that changed the oversight for HBCUs from the Department of Education to a director in the White House. That director has yet to be named. Joining me now on the line from Sandiston, Florida, is Dr. David Wilson. He's the president of Morgan State University here in Baltimore. Dr. Wilson, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be back.
And Johnny C. Taylor is with us as well. He's the president and CEO of the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. He joins us on the line from Washington. Mr. Taylor, welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
You are welcome to join our conversation as well. Our phone number here at Midday is 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Dr. Wilson, what was your motivation for attending the meeting with the president last month?
Tom, I think as the constituents at Morgan have come to know me, you know that I am a pretty transparent president, and I believe in consulting with all of the constituents of the university before I jump out too quickly on any issue, and especially one that is controversial, as this invitation from the Trump administration to come to the White House and to Congress, to Washington for a listening session was. And so when I got the invitation, of course, you have to take seriously the invitation coming from the president. But I also went into my transparent mode, and I made sure, I think much differently from some of the other HBCU presidents, that I consulted with my student leaders. I consulted with the faculty. I consulted with the alums all over the United States, the Morgan alums. And I had a very detailed conversation with the Board of Regents, letting them know that this invitation had come to me, and this is how I was thinking about it, and I wanted to hear directly from them. And so I did, I was, you know, very pleased that after hearing my point of view, they endorsed my going, because I think they understood that the president of Morgan was not really interested in just going to the White House for a photo op. I've been to the White House a gazillion times, and so going just for a photo op was just not something that I was interested in. I served as a member of President Obama's White House initiative on HBCUs, and so I understood the executive order signed by him as I understood that order signed by every president before President Obama. And so my primary reason for going was relatively simple. It was, number one, to make sure that as this new administration took shape, that there was a good understanding of the great history and mission and role and contributions of HBCUs, because I was led to believe, based on what I was seeing, that we have a lot of education to do, and I wanted to make sure that I was there lending a voice to that level of understanding. And the second was to see if this executive order was going to be any differently beyond just moving it from one agency to another than previous executive orders. And I was under the impression that this one might have an aspirational goal where federal agencies would look at the amount of money they oversee and basically look at investing anywhere from 5 to 10% of that in I institutions. And I thought if that indeed were the case, that would have been significant. And then lastly, Morgan is a major research institution. There are over 100 HBCUs, but we are not all a monolith. You have very elite liberal arts institutions, and you have 10 research institutions. And so I went to make sure that Morgan and other research institutions were not going to be overlooked in terms of developing our research capacity and to put us in a position where we can ascend and be competitive with any public comprehensive research university in the country. And so when I put all those things out there, coupled with the need on the part of our students for federal aid, particularly the Pell Grant, I think it was important to be a part of an initial conversation to try and shape the priorities and funding that could eventually come to our institutions.
And Mr. Taylor, your organization, the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, set up this meeting. Why did you think it was important to do it? The president, obviously, as we were talking in the first segment, a very divisive character, was certainly divisive during the campaign. He's been certainly highly criticized for sort of oversimplifying the complexities of black life in America. Were you concerned that he would be particularly unreceptive to help HBCUs?
No, actually, we were concerned that in our job at the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, which represents the country's public historically black colleges and universities, the state institutions, was to ensure that they actually knew who we were. You see, it's quite interesting. Many in the community have complained about the fact that we went and ignore the fact that over the prior 8 years, HBCUs as a group were not invited to the White House at all. Many of them complain about the fact that the White House initiative is now just in the White House and that doesn't mean anything. Well, the fact of the matter is it was three levels down within the Department of Education in the prior administration. And finally, many complain that ultimately we were not this first budget or the skinny budget that was released earlier this week did not specifically increase HBCU funding. But the reality, Tom, is that the president, President Obama's first budget, and it seems odd to me that no one wants to focus on the fact that his first budget cut HBCUs by $85 million from the prior year. So we needed to be there to ensure that the same thing that occurred in 2009 did not play out again this year in 2017.
And what does Mr. Trump's budget say about HBCUs in the outline that he proposed last week?
Two words stood out to me in bullet point number 5 in sort of the summary document. It said protect HBCUs and minority serving institutions and maintain the $492 million. So protect and maintain at a minimum, as Jared Carter, I think, properly pointed out, in an environment where all of the other departments were being cut, the fact that within the Department of Education, the HBCU line, Title III, that we know and appreciate and need so dearly, was protected, to me is amazing, because as opposed to digging out of a hole and going to Congress to get more money to actually top us up, we start at exactly where we ended 2016.
And Dr. Wilson, that probably is something that gives you cause for confidence. But what about the issue, for example, of Pell Grants? There are many students at Morgan and at HBCUs around the country who rely on Pell Grants for their higher education. And as I understand it, the Trump budget outline calls for cutting Pell Grants by $3.9 billion. How's that going to affect Morgan, for example?
Well, as Johnny indicated, you know, this is, quote unquote, the skinny budget. And I certainly think that between now and the time that the actual budget is developed, that individuals who are whispering in Mr. Trump's ear will let him know that I personally, and I think many of the other presidents with whom I have consulted, we don't think this is a good idea to cut the Pell Grant. During President Obama's tenure, the Pell Grant program was extended for 1 year to be a year-round program. And we saw in Morgan, as we saw on many of our other campuses, students took advantage of that. They could then finish their tenure at the institution in a much shorter time period. As a result, their level of indebtedness was decreased. We have, you know, 35% of students at Morgan who are first-generation college-going students. Those students are coming from homes where if they have a need for $2,000, they can't get on the phone and call their parents and say, put this on your American Express card. And so when you have a program that has been as successful as Pell, not just in terms of HBCUs, but in terms of all institutions in this country that are serving students coming from limited income families, and you have an opportunity to embellish that program, to extend the net of opportunity to those who have been locked out of higher education for so long, why wouldn't you take advantage of that? And so we certainly are hopeful that what happened with this executive order is not just symbolic. I certainly understand the position that Johnny is taking in terms of moving it to the White House, but my position personally is that I don't care where it is, so long as there is funding that is invested in our institutions that will enable them to respond to issues of infrastructure, that would enable students to persist to graduation, and that would enable us to develop innovation and research centers on our campuses. Regardless where the location is, if the funding is coming to the institutions, from my perspective, that is the ultimate goal. And certainly I hope that between now and October, that a restoration of the cuts to the Pell Grant program and extending that program year-round would actually make its way into the fully developed budget from the Trump administration.
Tom, I have to ask you now. The statement suggests that President Obama, first of all, that there was a cut to Pell. And the fact of the matter is Pell was not cut. It is the same level that President Obama approved the last time. And so anyone who suggests differently is not being totally being honest there. The fact of the matter is Pell was not cut. The $3.9 billion that everyone's talking about is a surplus. It was money that went unused in Pell last year. And they're requesting a reallocation, which, by the way, we hope can be used to bring back year-round Pell. This suggestion, and I heard President Wilson say, the suggestion that President Obama brought in year-round Pell is right, but it ignores the fact that then he took it away. So what we are trying to do is get it back under this administration. No one should leave your listening audience and believe that somehow President Obama brought in year-round Pell, and now what happened is $3.9 billion that was used to fund it is proposed to go away under the Trump administration budget. That's absolutely not true. That's false. We do not have year-round Pell and didn't have it for several years under President Obama. And so to suggest that somehow this is a bad place for us, what we're saying is we're pleased to see flat Pell. And what we're going to try to do is get the $3.9 billion reallocated back to year-round Pell, because it does not exist now.
Johnny C. Taylor is the president and CEO of the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. He joins us on the line from Washington. Dr. David Wilson is the president of Morgan State University. He's in Florida on the phone with us. You could be on the phone with us as well here at midday. I'm Tom Hall. You can call us at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @midday Tom Hall. Dr. Wilson?
Yes, I just wanted to be clear as well, because I don't want anyone who's listening to me to think that I am promoting something that is inaccurate. So Johnny's summary of this was accurate. What I indicated, I thought, was that President Obama did institute a year-round Pell for a year, and based on what we saw on the campus of Morgan, we felt that that was a very, very good thing. And so when the surplus was cut, that would have been a great opportunity to extend the Pell program back to being a year-round program, and that was the opportunity lost.
Several leaders of HBCUs were on the record saying that they were ultimately disappointed with the meeting at the White House last month. Dr. Wilson, what was your ultimate take? I mean, we heard from folks like President Kimbrough, Walter Kimbrough, who heads up Dillard University, saying that what had been planned kind of all blew up because all of a sudden President Trump wanted to have you and everybody at the meeting into the Oval Office for a photo, basically a photo opportunity. And then, ironically, even that photo opportunity was sort of overshadowed in that news cycle by the fact that Kellyanne Conway, a senior advisor to the president, took her shoes off and put her feet up on the couch in the Oval Office. And the picture of Ms. Conway doing that seemed to get a whole lot more circulation than the picture of the president with the leaders of the HBCUs. I mean, Mr. Taylor, for example, were you ultimately happy with the results of this meeting in February? Johnny Taylor, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So not only were we happy, you know, I hear often several presidents were unhappy, and there are a significant number. We have statements from over 25 of our presidents who were quite pleased with the meeting. President of Delaware State, President Williams, President of Albany State in Georgia, President Dunning. I can take you through a list of people, but the media seems not interested in talking with presidents who were quite pleased with the first step in this progress. But I think it's important to talk about, and normally I don't get off on this, but I have to, the Kellyanne photo that, frankly, the media has just decided it's not interested in hearing the real story. We all walked into the Oval Office. There were literally no photographers. And all of the presidents, the women presidents were told to leave your pocketbooks. The guys were told no cameras, etc. When we were all standing there, we, not President Trump, not his PR people, asked Kellyanne to take a picture of the group because we thought it was a momentous opportunity. The presidents asked her, one in particular asked her, would you please stand up, realizing that to get the panoramic view, she took off her shoes and stepped on the couch to take the picture at our request, not at the president's request. Shortly after that, the president said, bring in the media, the media press crew, because they can't get a big enough picture. And the photographer, White House photographer, asked Kellyanne to kneel because her head was in the middle of his picture. It was obstructing the view of the president, the picture of the president with the presidents of the HBCU community. So this, and we immediately went out and told the full media that this was not Kellyanne propping her foot up on a couch, disrespecting our community. We asked her to stand up, get on the couch so that she could get a full view of the 80 plus people in the room. But the media seems disinterested in that story.
All right. Well, we've heard that story now, and I'm glad. And so aside from Ms. Conway, and I appreciate your insight on that, Mr. Taylor, but President Wilson, were you ultimately happy? I mean, when we talk about people whispering into Mr. Trump's ear, we did hear from a number of people who said they really didn't get very much of a chance to make their views heard at the meeting either before or after they went into the Oval Office. What was your take?
Well, I think the intent of the meeting was good because it was billed as an opportunity for presidents to come and to express to the administration what our needs were. And to make sure that they were understanding those needs. And so this was supposed to be a listening session, and the agency heads or their representatives were supposed to be there, listen to a group of presidents, and basically take notes and begin to cogitate on those. So I think the intent of this was good. But what happened was that when you've been to the White House grounds, you know that some of these large meetings are not held in the White House itself, but in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. And so that's where we commenced what was supposed to be the listening session. And then as we settled in for that, we were told then that we would be going to the Oval Office to basically have a brief meeting with the president. And so physically getting from the Eisenhower Executive Office Building over to the White House. Quite a trek. And as a result, that ate up a lot of the time. And so by the time we went
so,
from
so
there...
So ultimately,
the
it, was, it back, was a good first step as far as you're
it,
concerned.
It was, yeah, it was a good first step. And mm-hmm. so I think for many of us, you know, we're looking now at what is to come after this. And so I would like to just hold judgment until we see... what the substance is going to be.
Sure. Let me try to sneak in a call. We just have a few minutes left. Robert on the line from Washington, D.C. Thank you for calling Midday. You're on with David Wilson and Johnny Taylor.
Thank you. So I have a comment and a question. My name is Robert from D.C., as you stated, and I'm a part of the HBCU Collective, which is a group of students, alumni, and friends who work in policy and advocacy. And we wanted to know, how are you all including your student body and your alumni in these interactions? I know that Dr. Wilson reached out to his student body and his alumni, his board of directors, but a lot of other presidents didn't. And we are getting ready to have a day of action, a direct action at the Capitol to advocate for our HBCUs because we love them and we want to work in conjunction with you. How is that taking place?
Dr. Wilson, you want to take that?
All I can do is speak on behalf of Morgan. And so, I reach out to my student leaders, meet with them regularly, and make them aware of issues like this. I had a conference call with the offices of the National Alumni Association and every president of a Morgan State Alumni Club across the country, and I do that regularly, and I would just offer that to other HBCU presidents and chancellors as a way of keeping everyone informed and involved in these major policy and other initiatives.
And Mr. Taylor, after the meeting that occurred, Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos issued a statement, and she called HBCUs the pioneers of school choice. Do you worry at all that she's co-opting or, somehow misappropriating HBCUs for a different political purpose?
Well, first, to the gentleman who made the call, reach out to us at the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, www.tmcf.org. Write us because we'd like to work with you. Currently, what we do is work with presidents because we don't have students. We represent we're the association for the schools. And so the college presidents, we believe, are like Dr. Wilson, are meeting with their students, their alumni, and bringing us the feedback that we incorporate into our overall strategy. But I'd love to have our people meet with you all to better understand what the collective wants us to do and would like us to advocate for. So thank you for your work. Back to the question, yes, there's no question that the Secretary's comments that our schools were schools of choice was just bad. I mean, there's no other way to say it. I was embarrassed. I was actually in the room when she said it. So I was sitting on the front row saying, what? That was really, really a very poor understanding, in fact, of our community. And so we are going to use this, frankly. You have a couple of ways. You can retaliate or you can educate. And I could have jumped up and made a ton of noise about it and jumped on the table. Instead, we pulled her to the side and said, you do understand these were not schools of choice. The choice was being made for us not to be able to attend majority institutions. Does it concern me? Yes. But as opposed to complaining about it, I'd like to do something about increasing her awareness of the history and the, frankly, the relevancy going forward, not just the historical relevancy, but the going forward relevancy of HBCU. So we see it as an opportunity.
Well, gentlemen, I appreciate the time that both of you have taken with us this afternoon to talk about this. This is an important issue. We are going to stay on it, and we look forward to the next time we speak to keep everybody abreast of the latest developments. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
Dr. David Wilson is the president of Morgan State University. Johnny C. Taylor is the president and CEO of the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. On April 27th, the HBCU Collective, and we just heard from Robert in D.C. He's one of the leaders of that organization. As he mentioned, they're sponsoring a day of action in D.C. They're calling for students, alumni, and friends to rally on Capitol Hill in support of historically black colleges and universities. We'll have more information about that, as well as links to information about Morgan State and the Thurgood Marshall College Fund on the web at wypr.org/midday. Coming up after a little break, Kara Ritter is the president and CEO of Big Brothers Big Sisters of the Greater Chesapeake. She'll join me to talk about the important work that they're doing pairing mentors with young people in Baltimore. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.